Thank you, Howard. Good morning. President Faust, Dean Hammonds, President Georgi, and President-elect Blair, and friends. With admiration for young Phi Beta Kappa members, and with gratitude for the sacrifices made by the families. As a professor of literature, I might reasonably be expected to speak about that. As a humanist, I address a subject more important, one that engages literature and the arts, yet draws from every natural and social science, changing them all, as well as altering business, medicine, and law. We squander our precious capital and endowment. We borrow against the future without saving for the shortfalls we create. To present in detail how we practice these reckless habits would provide a second college degree. Certainly, I'm not the person to do it. In this theater, many know better the fine print of our mortgage against tomorrow and the terms of a second bond issue or a third bailout. We've endangered communities, threatened livelihoods, destroyed homes and habitats, and released toxic products worldwide, wrongly rated AAA safe instead of XXX poison. No special blame is here assigned. As the prince says in Romeo and Juliet, all are punished. Lower markets and crippled portfolios are bad enough, but the worst results of our persistent habits will be permanent disruption of all that undergirds prosperity. States will fail, standards of living fall, and famine increase. This narrative refers not to one, but to two intimately related activities. The words for a complex set of human actions and a complex set of natural ones share, like a grove of aspen or sequoia, an identical underground root, oikos, Greek for house, economy and ecology. This underground root is not accidental and not parlor trivia. Ecology studies how nature manages her house, economics how humans manage theirs. But how can humans manage their house when it has become nature's, the planet itself? We deplete natural capital, freshwater, topsoil, coral reefs, rainforests, arable land, clean air, wetlands, the alveoli of Earth, biodiversity, faster than nature can replenish itself. We could go to ecological bankruptcy if we continue to use more than what nature can regenerate, warns Mathis Wackernagel of the Global Footprint Network. Simultaneously, we claim more humans are better off now than ever before. True. How can that be? We are living a giant Ponzi scheme played upon nature and Earth. It has become habit, but cannot be sustained. Nature will survive, Earth will endure, but humans who spend natural capital in this scheme will suffer most. No long-term capital hedge fund can succeed by unbalancing nature for long. Nature doesn't do derivatives. The deepest underlying value of all derivatives is nature. We might think less about that day in spring when we stop working to pay taxes and start working to pay ourselves, and consider instead Overshoot Day. That day each year when the human ecological footprint of our economies overtakes Earth's biocapacity to replenish. In 2006, it was calculated as September 23rd. For the rest of the year, we're engaged in ecological deficit spending. Humans extinguish species with speed matched only by prehistoric flood or meteor impact. We release toxins that accumulate in soil, water, and tissues of belugas and polar bears. We scramble to provide water and sanitation for 250,000 more people each day and fail, even as irrigation sucks down levels of aquifers in India, China, and the American West. And above all, we expel carbon dioxide in Earth's film of air so fast, we create a tipping point with uncharted descents on the future side. Mainstream media and mainstream politics now at least acknowledge these issues. Some businesses embrace them because that embrace provides efficiencies and generates profits. New industries and services emerge from environmental exigencies, and it's increasingly understood that no environmental issue stands isolated. No discipline studying any issue can therefore keep separate from other disciplines or from public or institutional policies. National security requires sustainability. Deforestation affects climate. Energy policy touches agriculture. Each becomes a nexus of others, a web. The basic law of ecology, says Barry Commoner, is that everything is connected to everything else. Despite heightened awareness of environmental concerns, it's vital to realize that these aren't cyclical, with boom, bubble, bust, and then recovery. Instead, they're cumulative. They become always more urgent. This era can't be likened to an environmental recession of 1982 or a depression of 1932. There's no reset button. Here is a sea change and not a tide. We've entered an unprecedented era, and it will last. Thomas Friedman calls it the energy climate era. Years ago, Thomas Berry called it the ecozoic era, the era of the house of life. Powerfully carried out since the Industrial Revolution and magnified by population increase, human domination of Earth's ecosystems cries out for strict accounting standards to avoid heavier liabilities. For every 1 degree centigrade rise in the average global temperature of the Earth, crop yields of current strains will fall by 10%. The bark of a tree native to Peru produced malaria treatment. Indigenous people in South America used penicillin long before Sir Alexander Fleming discovered it. The rosy periwinkle of Madagascar provides treatment for childhood leukemia. What species do we witlessly eclipse before finding out too late that we are smashing the medicine bottles in our own cabinet? The box we built for living has expanded to come smack up against the planetary limits for what nature, even with ingenious human coaxing, can supply without disruption or shortage. More fundamentally than it can be called anything else, globalization is environmental. Habits we relied on to get out of previous fixes are exactly not the habits we can turn to now. As Lester Brown quotes Amory Lovins, "We can no longer think outside the box. There is no box. The box is gone." So it's constantly underestimated how thorough, how radical, needs to be the reform of our daily habit, our learning, and our ethics. They require tectonic shifts. Whether we can, in one lifetime, your lifetime, achieve nothing short of a willed mutation of human behavior and habit, no one yet can answer. Now, here's one instance why such a change is so hard. In 2005, Congress passed a transportation bill giving 50 cents per gallon tax credit for the use of mixed fuels. This doesn't cut CO2 emissions much, but the intent was to reduce imported oil and rely more on domestic biofuels. Now, in making paper from wood pulp, pulp produces something called black liquor, which can be burned to run the entire undertaking. After initial startup, it's a pretty good closed system. Cellulose in the pulp gives enough energy to convert the rest of the pulp to paper. Yet, under the new law, if you add diesel fuel to black liquor, it qualifies as mixed fuel. And the government gives you half a dollar credit for each gallon. So that's what big players in the paper industry did, receiving $8 billion a year in tax credits for 16 billion gallons of mixed fuel, about one 55-gallon drum for each one of us, costing citizens $27 per person. Since the incentive could be perverted, it was. Asked why her company pursues, albeit legally, a practice that weakens national security, worsens environmental conditions, and whacks taxpayers, a vice president for international paper replied, like the Sphinx, "It is what it is." Now there's original sin, which means in this case, committing one that no one else has yet had the imagination to think of. But let's take a tougher case, closer to home. As personal economists, if we could calculate the negative environmental externalities of our daily habits, the hidden costs of making and using cars, homes, computers, food, heat, cell phones, air conditioning, plastic, and all the rest we build, buy, and own, the fact that these entail deforestation, polluted water and air, species destruction, and through climate shifts, rising sea levels, wilder wildfires, deeper floods, and more persistent droughts, we'd see that our daily habits cannot be sustained. The numerical value of these negative externalities would confront us as in a mirror, and we'd see natural capital running out in our hands. For instance, when the Texas Transportation Institute estimates that urban traffic jams cost the economy $78 billion in 1 year, it calculates this from 4.2 billion lost person hours and 2.9 billion gallons of wasted fuel. But there is no estimate for environmental damage caused by added CO2 and increased pollutants. Now, to exist this way was once called living in a fool's paradise. Let's call it what it is, our great-grandchildren's hell. Because we can't calculate all of those negative externalities and give them an exact formula or a reliable dollar amount, we largely ignore them and prefer short-term comfort, much of which is borrowed. Nature has zero ethical responsibility for us. She will let us take out large, unsecured loans. When we can no longer meet payments, she will silently and surely, with no sentiment whatsoever, repossess the house. After all, we're only tenants. Fueled by good intentions and entrepreneurship, but also by greed and self-interest, the recent financial meltdown took a decade to develop. Fueled by the same human qualities, the environmental meltdown has taken 2 centuries to heat up. It's pervasive and fiendishly difficult to calculate. Its reversal inestimably harder to achieve. The environmental meltdown is far more dangerous. Environmental challenges we've created require basic and applied science, technological innovation, entrepreneurial business, institutional actions, movements dedicated to change, government regulation, and incentives. 3 elusive but indispensable elements are also needed: reformed habits, redesigned learning, and new ethics. Inaction on any of these fronts will thwart all other efforts. Aristotle remarks that courage is the most important of virtues because without it, you can't exercise the others. Without changed habits, learning, and ethics, we will not only not be able to manage our house, we will not even be able to conceive of actions for adequate management. The great change must first come from within. First, habit is a huge force. Plutarch and Montaigne call it second nature. It's more than that. Habit is twice nature. William James, in the brilliant chapter on habit and the principles of psychology, says habit is the enormous flywheel of society. More than anything else, it resists change. The worst habits are insidious in the scientific and ethical sense, slow, hurting over time, by imperceptible degrees, therefore easily ignored or denied, addictive, treacherous, literally lying in wait for ambush. Smoking is insidious. Extinction of a species is often insidious. Burning big amounts of coal is insidious. Business as usual is insidious. Habits are values in disguise. They constitute what we buy to wear and what we build to live in, our habits and our habitats. The killer is that because insidious habit is so slow and so thorough, none of it rises to a catastrophe. Yet, like lung cancer, it's usually too late to reverse it. The enormity of such habit is that any warning that it's creating a crisis in slow motion seems powerless to stop the addiction, which is the essence of tragedy. Shakespeare's King Lear doesn't listen to his fool. When the king recognizes his own foolishness, it's too late to stop the suffering. Every day, the way we treat the natural world affects health, the risk of war and terrorism, motives for immigration, all future economies, and resources for social programs and sustainable jobs. The affluent have abused the natural world and now fall short in their responsibilities to help the developing world avoid more abuse. Giving comparatively little in foreign aid and structuring loan and trade agreements as we have, we fail to provide poorer nations and the people in them with the help they need to obtain a higher standard of living, to stop deforestation, pollution, and other damaging practices. In the last presidential campaign, Americans rated environmental concerns at number 17, like fake windows on the house rather than the foundation stones for it itself. It's good leadership to have an administration that puts them high in concert with other concerns. The current administration knows that in the end, a better economy depends dramatically on a better environmental economy. Yet habits die hard, especially in Congress. Although it could cover the budget shortfall of a national health care plan, we're unlikely this year to have cap and trade legislation for carbon, and even more unlikely to pass what we really need, a carbon tax. So all this means sacrifice, an emphatic change of personal habit and custom, those elusive qualities long regarded as at the very core of a liberal education. And it means smarter use of natural capital, starting with the trillions of megawatts of power that fall on Earth each day from the sun and that are latent in the wind. But let's see this another way and change the frame for just a minute. If it were known that an asteroid, you've probably seen those, Deep Impact, right? Or the other one, Armageddon, was it? Right. If it were known that an asteroid were hurtling toward Earth with a probability increasing each month that it would strike this planet in 40 years, raise sea levels 25 feet, put one quarter of known species in danger and force many extinctions, set off plagues, flood parts of nations, submerge populated islands, evacuate thriving cities, intensify hurricanes, and shorten or end the lives of millions of people, then every government would be working furiously to discover how that asteroid could be diverted or destroyed. There is no such asteroid, as far as we know. But all the rest in this scenario is likely true, with evidence for it mounting a little each hour. It's happening insidiously from billions of habits daily thrown together like unscrupulous pebbles until their combined force matches the impact of a heavenly body. It's our own burning of carbon. To those now graduating, you will exert power that will only grow, domesticated through technologies you will invent, guided by policies you will formulate, enforced by laws you will write, enlivened by goods you will produce, exercised by societies you will help to govern. Yet the bedrock of all power you exert comes straight from habits of thinking and acting that even now are tempering themselves into values that hold Earth and all its inhabitants in the balance. Communities at all scales must work together in ways that we never have before. Almost anyone who kicks a bad habit and tries to start a good one will testify how invaluable a support group can be. Change your habits so that you can help change the habits of others, and by this alchemy, one will become many. Now, if the odds stick, it's a fair bet one or more of you will receive a Nobel Prize, a good chance at a Pulitzer, and an excellent outlook to win a MacArthur Genius Grant. Then, remember what William James said, and had they existed in his day, he could have won all three. Genius, says James, in truth, means little more than the faculty of perceiving in an unhabitual way. We're now engaged in a revolution whose aim is not to secure freedom from a tyrant, but to free us from the tyranny of our own habits. Between now and 2050 in this country, we need to change from emitting 20 tons of carbon dioxide per person per year to one. When I was a student, I sat in this theater reading Robert Frost's poem, It's Almost the Year 2000, and thought, how foolishly I thought that was so far away. When I was a boy at night, in high summer, I'd hear through screens of the bedroom in the lakeside cottage my grandfather built the voice of the whippoorwill, repeated from the forest floor and coming across the old dirt road. It haunted my nights and promised an enchanted world in this world, not to dominate or to develop, but to receive as a natural blessing that makes life more bearable, more lovely. The whippoorwill is gone, deeper into the woods. Ornithologists don't know exactly why the bird has declined so drastically, but I suspect my own habits have had something to do with forcing it on its way. Second, learning. By habit to which I was a party, the new general education program, for all its strengths, includes nothing yet that could be construed as a genuine environmental requirement. However, there's no learning now more vital for human and for non-human nature than environmental education. It's utilitarian, it's relevant, yet it's also idealistic. It rests on a tripod of scientific, social, and humanistic knowledge. It requires knowledge of nature, approaches to mass behavior, expression of human relations with the natural world, how to act, and what policies to enact. Knock away one leg of this tripod, and precarious imbalance occurs. Ever narrowed expertise grappling with ever interconnected problems. Institutions that generate knowledge of nature, society, and self as they impinge on one another, colleges and research universities, hold one key to a reformed future. Yet the interdisciplinary space par excellence is the grade school classroom. Kindergarten is the seedbed to plant environmental education of habit. In fact, it's ideal. One example in middle schools is Bertha Vasquez of Coral Gables, Florida, who as a science teacher has made learning green in math, French, language, the visual arts, and has transformed her entire school. Our curricula can renovate themselves to create a sustainable world, but they must move much more swiftly. Education ties in with habit, too. As William James urges, the great thing in all education is to make our nervous system our ally instead of our enemy. It is to fund and capitalize our acquisitions, says James, and live at ease upon the interest of the fund. For this, we must make automatic and habitual as early as possible as many useful actions as we can. Third, a new ethic. Education and habit constitute an ethic put into action. But 3 points only. One, an environmental inflection of virtue goes hand in hand with science, technology, and public policy. Ethical habit without technology becomes insufficient, and technology without ethical habit becomes destructive. Two, changes in habit, policy, and learning require hard work. In his journal about Cape Cod, Henry David Thoreau reports that the residents of Truro on the Cape were, quote, regularly warned to plant beach grass. In this way, they built up again that part of the Cape where the sea broke over in the last century. Thus, Cape Cod is anchored to the heavens, as it were, by a myriad little cables of beach grass, and if they should fail, would become a total wreck and ere long go to the bottom. Three, every world religion and ethical leader, East and West, Socrates, Moses, Mencius, Gandhi, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, as well as founding fathers of this nation, and let's add Adam Smith too, they all promote well-being, but universally condemn luxury. We, meanwhile, are stuffed with luxury. Luxury cars, luxury homes, luxury cruises, luxury yachts, luxury vacations, luxury condos, hotels, luxury sports boxes, luxury executive jets. On average, these consume by far the most energy in their class and deplete natural capital the quickest. It's no coincidence that we never hear that word luxury applied to things we need more of: bicycles, public transportation, light rail, recycling, walking shoes, farmers markets. Luxury comes from luxuria and luxus, meaning excess, originally something overly ripe, spoiled, rotten. Luxury is waste. Luxury is a luxury we can't afford. There are no end users, no mere consumers. There are only stewards. People will spend money as they please, but Thoreau's Walden provides a healthy reminder. Most of the luxuries, says Thoreau, and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only not indispensable, but positive hindrances to the elevation of mankind. The ancient philosophers, Chinese, Hindu, Persian, Greek, were a class than which none has been poorer in outward riches, none so rich in inward. The same is true of more modern reformers and benefactors. Now, habit learning and ethics ring completely hollow without real human embodiment. What most immediately they shape is not a policy or program, but a living person who has transformed from within and then relentlessly seeks better programs and better policies. So I want to give two examples. Beatrix Potter, daughter of an industrialist, drew artistically with the eye of a scientist and wrote with the ear of an artist. When young, she recognized that lichens comprise a symbiosis of fungi and algae and drew them in exquisite detail. But the officials at Kew Gardens, seeing a woman without the right degree or credential, rejected her. She made her fortune writing hugely popular children's books, the Peter Rabbit books, then used her knowledge of nature, lifelong passion for the English Lake District, and hard-won literary and ecological wisdom to save, there's no other word for it, to save thousands and thousands of prime acres from development that would have damaged humans, animals, and plants. She championed the Hardwick sheep and the stable, beautiful ecology of the English Lake District and its household farms. Second example, Rachel Carson, born near Pittsburgh, who in college studied English and science, then took a master's in biology. Researching for the federal government, she published in professional journals, popularizing a phrase she didn't invent, but understood better than anyone else, nature's delicate balance. She authored The Sea Around Us and then Silent Spring, the working title for which was the less poetic, but still accurate, Man's War Against Nature. After Silent Spring appeared with its indictment of excessive use of DDT, Carson was reviled as a dilettante, a woman, and even a communist. Men in white lab coats in slick film productions cast aspersions on her knowledge and worth. A woman, a government underling, a biologist, not a chemist, and after all, DDT was a chemical. But as biology and chemistry are far closer than was imagined then, can we accept that the arts and sciences are in fact far closer than we habitually imagine them now? She thought so. Carson loved the poet Keats, and with justified poetic license applied these lines from his poem, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, to the effects of DDT. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Three quick corollaries from new habit learning and ethic. First, the challenge of ensuring ecological activity that undergirds, not undercuts, sustained economic activity can't be met in a few years. As with abolition, labor rights, civil rights, women's rights, animal rights, sexual rights, and the right to worship freely, this struggle is long. But there's no time to lose. Second, if one denigrates habit learning and ethics as somehow secondary or soft, one corrective comes to mind. Since at least Vietnam, all failures of our foreign policy have not been caused by an inability to project power or for lack of economic, technological, or military might, but instead because of our leaders' ignorance of the history, religion, culture, and language of other people and nations. In short, ignorance of habits, education, and ethics. Third, security requires sustainability, and whatever postpones a sustainable world, for example, proposals to drill endlessly or educate women less, undermines the security it claims to create. As with mine subsidence or particulate air pollution, as with every insidious habit, the erosion of security may not appear soon, but will trump the only time frame that matters, a future that arrives rudely unannounced. In Somalia, more than 250 desperate people have died fighting over one water well. To extrapolate that event takes little imagination. The Stern Report on economics and the climate suggests that to prevent more rapid climate shifts and mitigate those shifts that are now unavoidable, it's wise to pay a small insurance premium. This entails self-denial. Yet asceticism of this sort, says William James, is like the insurance which a man pays on his house and goods. The tax does him no good at the time, that's true, and possibly may never bring him a return. But if the fire does come, his having paid it will be his salvation from ruin. So with the man who has daily inured himself to habits of concentrated attention, volition, and self-denial in unnecessary things. It's safe to say that almost all luxury cars, condos, homes, furs, yachts are well insured. Not to pay a few percentage points of GDP for an insurance policy against climate shock is bad management, bad business, and terrible national security. Arguments against all that has been urged here are multiple. The easiest is denial, which is the junkie's bodyguard. The more that denial is discredited, the more stubbornly it protects its boss. Its prime tactic paints any contrary evidence as inconclusive. As that evidence mounts, denial will perversely claim it points only to more uncertainty. Denial appears as a thug in a three-piece suit. When Harry Marco Polos first looked at Bernie Madoff's hedge fund, he smelled fraud. His calculations proved Madoff's reported gains couldn't be matched by any known market strategy. 9 years ago, Marco Polos tipped off the SEC in Boston, and they tipped off New York. But as someone quipped, New York does not like to receive tips from Boston. Besides, Harry wasn't well connected. Wearing orange shirts and weird ties, he could seem uncouth. Just smart. He wrote more reports, a detailed one in 2005. Still, no response. In an uncanny way, this mirrors the Intergovernmental Panel reports on climate change from the mid-1990s until now, each more urgent and detailed, each denied in high places. Washington did not like to receive tips from Geneva. Good people, fine institutions, and many households lost $50 billion in Madoff's scam. Our pyramid scheme against nature is toting up a sum that will make that look puny. After denial, the second argument against radical reform goes like this: people will never change unless driven by economic pressure or disaster. Pressure is mounting. American auto companies are out on a limb due in part to environmentally underperforming products. Natural disasters are picking up pace. The entire erosion of Alaska's northwest coast, floods in Venezuela that killed 30,000 people a decade ago, a European heat wave that killed tens of thousands in 2003, 50 million spruce trees in Alaska victim to climate shock. Bangladesh, Pacific Island nations, and the Indonesian archipelago are all now subject to more storm damage and loss of life. A few weeks ago, in Bangladesh, cyclones killed hundreds and made hundreds of thousands of people homeless. But there weren't big headlines about it here. Waiting for disaster to hit home when something can be done about it is like holding the lightning rod in your hand instead of installing it on the roof. It's pure luck that lightning hasn't struck yet. The third protest is simple. The environment can't save itself, but the market will do the trick. Today, that seems a particularly sick joke. The bumper sticker might read, "Market failures happen." They happen most often in environmental areas, which increasingly means more markets. Robert Stavins, a Harvard economist, explains why the market is bad as a mechanism to provide environmental equilibrium. He says environmental economists are interested in pollution and other externalities, where some consequences of producing or consuming a good are external to the market, that is, not really considered by producers or consumers. With a negative externality, such as environmental pollution, the total social cost of production may thus exceed whatever value there is. If the market is left to itself, too many pollution-generating products get produced. In this case, laissez-faire markets, because of the market failure, are not efficient. Indeed, he says, in the environmental domain, perfectly functioning markets are the exception rather than the rule. Another argument not to change habits, learning, or ethics is that technology will save the day. We can develop methods to drill in the Arctic Ocean for more oil once all the ice has melted. We can deploy giant shades hung from satellites to block the torrid sun. But to trust a technology fix alone is exactly the habit that put us and the Earth in the state we are now. Sometimes it's objected that environmentalists act for what is not human rather than for human good. This dichotomy is false. Human beings dominate Earth's ecosystems. The only way to help ourselves is to help what is not ourselves, for the symbiosis is deep. And this is why compassion, not cleverness or force, is the deepest value. Francis Bacon, the West's first great scientist, put it this way: nature is not conquered save by obeying it. And the most seductive voice of all says, we don't need to sacrifice. I earned the right to do as I please. I paid for it. Yet that claim assumes a mature life, and why should we have life and enjoy it when many do not and cannot? The powerful man who had knights, wealth, family, and friends, King Lear, ends as a bare-forked animal exposed to storm, and then holding his dead daughter in his arms, straining to see her breathe, laments, "Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all?" He receives no reply. Who or what gives life? If it's God, then let us not undo God's gift so much. If it's life itself, passing on through cell, slime, root, sperm, egg, in a shattered, evolving continuum lasting millions of years and giving us a mass of organized cells that, once they lack the energy to live together miraculously, return to the general slurry of dead cells, from there to be separated into molecules, some recollected in new and living bodies, stalks or stems. But is this something we have earned? It seems instead a gift. Walt Whitman sings at the start of Song of Myself, "For every atom belonging to me belongs as good to you." As another man said, "Whoever remains in me and I in him will bear much fruit." All our cells return to that slurry, save the single sperm and egg that sacrifice their identities to merge as one new life, singular, a gift to parents and to those who adopt in love and compassion. So what is sacrifice but giving back a gift with interest? Every dollar I make that is not balanced against nature's account is a dollar I can enjoy now, but it inflicts a debt on my daughter and my son that they must pay, with an added penalty for my early withdrawal. If it's urged that God has granted humans dominion over creation, then Samuel Taylor Coleridge gives an apt reminder to reverence that power. The book of nature, he says, is likewise a revelation of God, and the language of nature is a subordinate logos. The final dismissive response to an environmental era is, "I know all this. Tell me something I don't know." A clear reply comes from William James. "No matter how full a reservoir of maxims, no matter how good one's sentiments may be, if one have not taken advantage of every concrete opportunity to act, one's character may remain entirely unaffected for the better." Not to exaggerate, but for plain emphasis, let us note that none of us can yet conceive how unrecognizable will need to be the changes in our habitual actions. We will be as amazed as those first passengers riding in a railway carriage who feared that traveling at the ungodly speed of 25 miles an hour would annihilate their bodies and rip apart their limbs to send them flying through space. In preparing these remarks, it was always clear how inadequate they would be. They can only whisper to conscience. In this case, no one can speak truth to power heroically, for we all collectively constitute that power. The best speech is not an oration, but reformed habit, new learning, a changed ethos, and vigorous action. There are solutions, even with off-the-shelf technologies available now. It is possible to manage this house. If reform is everywhere within, then the leadership you now begin to assume, while arduous, will achieve success. Success shared with other communities and passed on to the next generation with hope, not massive debt. Let us continue our sacrifices so that we may sustain our gifts. There is in life a sustainability of spirit that, if we greet it generously, intelligently, compassionately, links generation to generation, and also humanity to its larger house, which is our only home. Thank you.